It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh Public Schools Superintendent Anthony Hamlet said Tuesday that students could start returning to the classrooms for in-person learning as early as January 27th, which is the start of the second semester. WESA's education reporter Sarah Schneider monitored that media briefing, and she joins us now. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Kevin.
Sarah, Pittsburgh Public Schools tried phased-in classroom instruction in November, but abandoned that in a few days when COVID cases in the county spiked. Did you get any sense, any level of confidence that in-person classes could begin before the end of this month? How confident were they?
Well, I think could is the key word there. It's a big maybe. There's a lot up in the air, and there is not a return date for students right now. You know, students could return January 27th. That's the start of the second semester. And teachers are expected to be back in their classrooms the week of January 18th. But it's important to note that this would be a small group of students. Cohort D is students with disabilities or students with learning English as a second language. And remote learning has been especially challenging for them. And, you know, the district wants them back in person, but it is hard to say if that will happen this month or when the phasing in of the rest of students will begin. The superintendent, Anthony Hamlet, said the administration will review state data released on January 15th to determine if or when students and staff will return to schools.
At this point, do they have further phases? In other words, when grades 6, 7, and 8, when high schoolers will return, or is that still to be determined?
That is still to be determined. The district's contracted physician, Dr. Martin Gregorio, says that they are evaluating community transmission by, you know, two numbers. That's the percent positivity and the incidence rate. And the Department of Education recommends that counties with substantial spread be fully remote. And as of January 1st, all Pennsylvania counties were at the substantial level of community spread.
What safety protocols are they planning on when students do return to the classrooms?
Mm-hmm. There's a plan available at on the district's website. It includes, you know, masking for students and plans for how teachers can socially distance their classrooms. That hasn't been used yet. You know, as you mentioned, it was used for a few days in November, but at that point there were so few students that a lot of that didn't have to be put in place. So it's still kind of up in the air. Those plans will have to be revisited.
I'm sure they'll include physical distancing and I believe masks for students more than 2 years old, I believe.
Correct. Yes, correct.
Have they worked with teachers on any of these plans, whether it was what was announced on Tuesday or in the past?
Teachers were involved in the all-in process. That was called the all-in to reopen our schools. The teachers' union was represented in that planning process as well.
Mm-hmm. Will parents, so let's go positive in terms of optimistic. Let's go optimistic. Mm-hmm. And they are able to begin a phased-in of students gradually in the classrooms. But will parents still have the option to say, no, I want my kids learning from home. I want my kids learning remotely still.
If the district does return, it will be a hybrid model with, you know, different cohorts of students returning on different days. And so parents will still have the option, or at least the district has indicated that the parents will still have the option to opt in or out.
Mm-hmm. What is the district considering for over the summer instruction to possibly help bridge any learning gap that developed for some students?
Right. Yeah. Hamlet says the district will have to address substantial learning loss. And board members have said at, you know, public meetings that some students just simply are not learning right now and that there are many students who are just getting by. And so Dr. Hamlet did say that he's asking principals to put together action plans for struggling students. Again, that's an ask. Those plans have not been developed yet.
Sarah Schneider is WESA's education reporter. Thanks so much, Sarah.
Yep. Thank you, Kevin.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Environmental Protection Agency recently updated its rules for detecting and replacing water pipes contaminated with lead. The new rules for the first time require testing in some schools and childcare facilities. Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority announced this past summer that it reached its lowest lead levels in 20 years. PWSA donated to Women for a Healthy Environment following a court settlement to continue fighting the issues of unsafe drinking water in Pittsburgh. Michelle Nakarati-Chapkis is the Executive Director of Women for a Healthy Environment, a nonprofit focused on bringing attention to environmental injustices facing the Pittsburgh area, specifically when it comes to safe drinking water. So, Michelle, welcome to the program.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
Michelle, what are some parts that are particularly stand out from these new rules to you?
Well, the new rules, there's a little bit of good and a little bit of not so great. And, you know, in some aspects, it feels like we're making progress. And in some aspects, it feels like it's a little bit of window dressing, to be honest with you. If we want to talk about the things that seem like they are on the right path, under the new rule, a sample must have a sampler, which is the individual who's going to collect the water for testing, has to draw 4 liters of water before collecting that test sample so that the water is more likely to come from the lead service line and not the internal plumbing of a building. So before there was just the one draw, which didn't give a true reflection of whether or not there was a lead service line present. Now all water systems have to develop a lead service line inventory or demonstrate the absence of the lead service line within 3 years of the final rule publication. So that's good. But there are some things that are not so great. And one of those is now that it's going to take a lot longer, potentially, for lead service line replacements to occur. So cities will now be required to replace just 3% of the lead service lines each year rather than the previous 7%. Now, the EPA will argue and say, well, water systems weren't achieving that 7%. But in places like our region with PWSA, we were indeed achieving that 7%. So now we know it could potentially take several decades beyond to replace leaded pipes that we have underground and are impacting our water quality.
Are you concerned that PWSA will fall back to that 3% level instead of the 7% since they were on target, even basically ahead of schedule?
PWSA, they have made a commitment to replacing all of their lead service lines within the year, I believe, 2026. And so I suspect and I would hope and encourage that they would keep on track with that.
Mm-hmm. These are federal rules that we're talking about. Are they requirements that local and state officials have not already been doing other than the percentage of replacement? I mean, PWSA says they've already implemented copper and lead restrictions.
There's definitely some work to be done moving forward under the new rule, because under the new rule, there has to be an inventory in place of all lead service lines. And so that's something that it is a positive moving forward. We need to know where the lines are in order to replace them. But there's this other point of partial line replacements. And so with the new rule, it doesn't say that partial line service replacements are prohibited. They can continue. They just won't count toward the new requirement for mandatory replacement rates. And so that's a concern, because we know that when systems do partial lead service line replacement, it actually produces more lead, it disturbs the pipes, and it makes people more susceptible to being impacted by lead and lead poisoning, frankly, through the water.
So let's clarify, partial lead replacement, is that replacing the service lines up to the curb and then letting it, whatever the lines are from the curb into the home, into the building, stay?
That's right. It's replacing what's known as the public side, which is owned by the water system, the water authority, and the private side, as you mentioned, from the curb to the home.
Right. As we mentioned, one new requirement of these EPA rules is testing in some schools and childcare facilities. How prevalent is lead exposure in those places overall?
Under the new rule, schools and childcare centers must be tested every 5 years. Or another way to look at it is that a water authority, a water system, has to test 20% of the schools and childcare centers within its service area. But we know that simply testing is not enough, and we have to require remediation in order to solve the problem. Our organization, in collaboration with Green Building Alliance, runs what we call the 1,000 Hours Program. It's an ability for schools and childcare centers to submit an application to get funding to test and remediate for lead. And that could be lead in paint, soil, dust, and certainly water. And that's where we've seen the highest amount of applications come through. And what we have found in the 200 plus buildings that we have been in over the last several years, almost 300 buildings, is that lead has been detected in every learning facility. And so we know that we are in the northeastern part of the country where it's aging infrastructure and we have lead pipes. And so we're spending, frankly, a lot of time testing and not enough money remediating.
PWSA says it's reached its lowest lead levels in 20 years. Do you consider that a success? I mean, 5 parts per billion still can cause lasting damage to cognition, according to the American Academy of Pediatrics. Should the EPA lower its max levels of lead in water that are permitted?
Yes, it should. And that's one of the areas that the ruling falls short, frankly, because it still keeps the action level of 15 parts per billion in place. They reference a trigger level of 10 parts per billion, but that really just requires systems to start planning and monitoring. It doesn't enforce any particular action for lead service line replacement. The science tells us that there's no safe amount of lead. And so really, you know, we need to get down to zero. And when we get down to zero, that means that there's no lead in the system.
And does that only happen when all lead lines are replaced?
You know, we need to really be thinking comprehensively about replacing all of our lead service lines throughout the region. And that has to happen at the federal and state level to really provide the resources and funding to the local water systems, the water authorities, to making that happen.
Finally, what's the future look like for Pittsburghers who have been directly impacted for years by unsafe drinking water?
The future's promising. I mean, we definitely are making progress and we've seen a significant amount. I believe PWSA is well over 4,000 lead service lines that have been replaced to date and they're on track to many more, certainly. Frankly, I'm a little bit more concerned with all of the other water systems. We have close to 40 water systems all throughout Allegheny County who may not have the resources and the technical expertise and the funding in place to accomplish the goals of doing full lead inventories. And so it begs the question of how will these systems work together to advance and to meet the needs so that they know where their inventory is and have a plan to replacing it. I think that's going to be the critical question that we need to ask now moving forward.
Is that regional cooperation among water systems a must in your mind?
I think it's crucial now. I think it's especially when we're talking now about lead service lines, partial line replacements, inventories, testing availability. You know, those are all things that if we have a collaborative can work together to really make sure that the residents of this region are safe and protected from lead in drinking water.
Michelle Nakarati-Chapkis is the Executive Director of Women for a Healthy Environment. Michelle, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Erie County is well known as one of Pennsylvania's swing counties, one which went for President Donald Trump in 2016, but flipped to President-elect Joe Biden last November. Judging by the switch, you wouldn't be blamed for thinking it a starkly divided community. But a conversation with some voters shows many are more willing to work toward common goals than seek out what separates them. WITF Sam Dunklaw led the recent chat as part of the America Amplified project.
About a month after the election, I went to Erie to talk to people about how they were processing Democrat Joe Biden's victory, as well as the president's refusal to concede and the repeated calls for Americans to look past their divisions. I rounded up 7 people for a Zoom call, 5 Democrats, 2 Republicans, 4 men, 3 women. One's a retired pastor. A few are nonprofit leaders. Another is a teacher and business leader. 2 worked for Pennsylvania governors of opposite parties. Barb Chafee is one of the people who worked for a governor, Republican Tom Ridge. She was a longtime Republican, but voted for Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden.
I don't perceive what was my Republican Party, the party I was a member of, as the party of Trump.
Republican Jesri Friend, however, is for Trump. But he wants people to know there's nuance in that decision.
There's probably 19 different reasons why someone may have voted for a Trump, or very different than maybe my reason. Let's start by not assuming things of others.
This is how the group started answering one of the key questions of the night. What does unity, in a political sense, mean to each of you? David Tamulonis, an event manager at the nonprofit Erie Downtown Partnership, doesn't think it means much at all.
I think we should strive for solidarity, building relationships and shared goals and objectives rather than unity, which seems to be sort of a naive buzzword and a concept that seems a little bit out of reach right now.
Kate Phillips feels the same way. She worked for Democratic Governor Ed Rendell before founding her own consulting firm.
I don't think that unity requires everyone to agree. And I think that we've had a long history in this country of having differing opinions and philosophies and different reasons for going to the polls.
Corey Cook, a logistics worker and musician philanthropist, says people can't hope to start talking to one another productively without building a bridge to a common goal.
We all have different ideas of how to get there. And, you know, that might differ from people from different backgrounds. But at the end of the day, we should be able to unify over the common idea of bettering people's lives.
As our Zoom call went on, I asked the panel to think about what's stopping that bridge building from happening in Erie. Democrat Chuck Camerata took a stab at it. He's a retired pastor who's involved with a group that brings together people of different religions and political leanings to figure out how to talk to one another. But he says bridge building is a slow process.
I think Americans don't feel like we have a lot of time. And secondly, Americans tend to be pretty impatient people to begin with. So if we can't fix it right away with, you know, three short steps, then we're frustrated by that.
Kelly Armour, the folk art director at the nonprofit Erie Arts and Culture, works a lot with the city's large new American population. She says cultural festivals put on by people from all over the world do a lot to improve understanding. But like so many things, that's been hampered by the pandemic.
Now we're even more in our own little silos, spending more time on social media. I think the fact that you have death threats on social media is blocking bridges to understanding.
Despite all that, in the course of our conversation, something kind of cool happened. Republican Jeffrey Friend and Democrat Kate Phillips were talking about education policy, whether more money for schools produces better results.
I will tell you the short version was no. I am convinced.
My short answer is yes.
Interesting. You and I are going to get coffee real soon and talk about that, because I would love to pick your brain on that more.
Kate remembered the offer as the chat wound down and revealed that she was maybe thinking a little differently about someone who voted for the candidate she didn't.
In the hour that we spent on this Zoom, I just can't imagine you saying, you know, calling someone Pocahontas or, you know, just all these things. Like, I can't imagine that. You seem like a pretty cool guy. Like, that's pretty nice, you know?
Just like that, simply talking led to the first step in building a bridge. Sam Dunklaw, WITF News, Erie.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Tom Hurley, Isabel Schmaler, Lara Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.